You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents
Monster Talks, a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Food with Mark Bittman, Big Picture Science, and Fork in the Road. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. We're back with another episode for you. Thank you for all the kind wishes that people sent me regarding my health. I had a nasty gut infection that sent me to the emergency room, but I'm delighted to say that it responded well to antibiotics and my health bar is almost back to full. In this episode, Karen and I are going to discuss three mini mysteries that you might have some thoughts on, or at least I hope you do. I don't think any of them are supernatural at the root of it, but they're all steeped in folklore, and some of them are very, very new, and some of them are very, very old. So, without further ado...
Monster Talk.
So, Blake, it's just the two of us again today, and I think we've got an interesting little topic, or set of topics. So, Well, you and I were always going on about critical thinking and the scientific method here on the show. But you thought that it would be fun and even inspiring for some listeners to collaborate and ponder some unsolved mysteries that we hear about online and just people tell us about that kind of thing. So we're going to discuss some topics that we've come across in our research that are really too brief for an entire episode.
Yeah.
They might be of interest and perhaps even worthy of some actual academic effort by some aspiring young scientists out there. So today we're going to talk about some weird phenomena that really do happen in nature and one frontier folklore claim that might make for an interesting science fair project.
Yeah, exactly.
Science fairs, just briefly.
Yes, yeah, do explain for people who don't have them, yeah.
Please do, yeah, because I'm not sure about the UK. In Australia, we didn't have them when I was growing up. I don't know if we've got any secondary level educators out there who might correct me, but we didn't really have that kind of thing. But I know it's big here. My son's 8. He's not doing anything like that yet. But if you want to tell us what they are.
Well, so when I was growing up, they were things that were held every year, but it wasn't part of the regular curriculum. It was like this extracurricular thing. It would be like a one night science fair, and people who participated would put their projects out. And I did it a couple of times. I wasn't very good, but you're supposed to have a testable hypothesis and do the experiment yourself. Usually you can tell whose parents help a lot and whose don't. But the idea is to teach kids how to think scientifically and test a claim. So, you know, there's this whole question of what is science exactly, and the definition has changed over time. But largely today, we think about science as being a methodology for testing whether claims are true or not. And so people in the public, in the general public, might imagine that science tells us what's fact. But the reality is science is good at helping you identify what's not fact. And theoretically, you would be reducing the number of false ideas out there. So, but these science fair projects could be little things. They could be try an experiment to test a hypothesis about, you know, climate change or recycling or physics. I remember in my elementary school, a student wanted to try out a solar-powered water heating device. And she and her father built a system to, like, pump water up to the roof. And then it, like, set in a dark box and then got heated by the sun and then pumped back warm water back into the house. It was kind of neat. But, I mean, they get pretty elaborate. But anyway, it's got to be something testable.
You're making me think of Emily Rosa. Do you
remember? Yeah, absolutely. Classic example.
Yeah, the therapeutic touch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Her experiments into that.
That's sort of the gold star example of somebody who not only did a science fair project, but actually got it published in an academic journal. So.
Oh, yeah. Dream version of that. But let's get into some of these topics. So Bigfoot tree forts, that's the first one that you wanted to talk about, otherwise known as Sasquatch teepees.
Yeah, but probably culturally insensitive, but a common thing that they're called. I can put some pictures to these in the show notes. This is a thing that Bigfoot hunters report frequently these days. So it's a common idea that Bigfoot build structures, but, you know, sometimes by literally ripping trees out of the ground and stacking them in a sort of I'm going to call it a teepee formation, a pyramidal where the tops of the trees are close
Blair
together.
Witch Project.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And
that's what they look like to me. And are these for living in or what?
No, one thing you might infer is that Bigfoot like to construct these after storms. Okay.
So you're saying
I think when a tree falls in the forest, if it lands onto another tree, sometimes it creates structures. Sometimes they fall flat to the ground. Sometimes they lean on each other. And sometimes they form these really weird interlocked structures. So,
I'm looking at some of the interesting photographs that you've supplied for me to have a look at. And some of them look like they could involve some human intervention, not Bigfoot intervention.
Yeah, so some of them do look like they might have been the product of agency. And I would infer assume humans if it was agency. I don't know of any evidence that, you know, animals are stacking these things orderly. This is why it's a mystery, right? So on the one hand, you could just bring Occam's razor to bear and say, well, we don't have any proof that Bigfoot's a real animal. Therefore, attributing these structures to the work of Bigfoot is a big, big, big stretch. It's literally bringing in an unjustified solution. Like, there's nothing to, you know, it could just as easily be aliens or fairies or anything else, because we don't know, right? So,
I want to say, too, just looking at some of these kind of reminds me of when you come across, you go for a hike and you see someone has just stacked stones in a pile.
That's what you think. What?
Human intervention. Well, or Bigfoot, obviously.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's finding patterns in what you expect to be a fully chaotic environment. Of course, I would point out, though, that's a human approach to thinking about this, because the nature, you know, it's a random world and it's super random, except it isn't. I mean, animals and plants enforce structure on the world because we're built of structure. We're self-organizing, living things. So a forest is not random. You know what I mean? A forest may look random if you look at the placement of the trees, but every one of those trees that survived by surviving, pressures that could have killed them. So they're the winners. It's sort of a survivorship bias. And when these trees get knocked over, the ones that lay flat are automatically excluded from the Bigfoot home structures here. But the ones that land bumping on other trees are, they're fitting the pattern. And so mm-hmm. I think there's a, to some extent, what you have is these are a little bit unusual because it's not what happens every time. But it's like dropping, you know, if you flip coins, you would say, well, you know, it's a 50-50 thing. So if you flip the coins 100 mm-hmm. times, you would expect around a 50-50 thing. But
sure. But
really, if I flipped a coin 100 times, sometimes that penny or whatever is going to roll out of the way and land under the couch, and you know, or it's going to go uh-huh. down a storm drain. So there are things that happen that we don't put into our numbers in our modeling.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. But certainly to look at these, they're interesting looking, but a lot of them just do look very natural. It doesn't look like there's any agency necessarily other than Mother Nature, a storm.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking as a thought experiment or something maybe people could think about. One obvious way to approach this would be to find a forest where we know that there's no Bigfoot for sure,
mm-hmm.
and see if these structures happen. Right, so they tend to be with in pine forests, and I think. That's because the nature of pine trees is they tend to be thin and flimsy. They bend well, but you know when they fall in a storm, you know the top of them is where the branch structure is, and the bottom generally mm-hmm. is like a toothpick. So they kind of lends itself to catching at the top and creating this sort of leaning structure. But I don't, you know, it's kind of I don't think that's really a great idea because I don't believe there's anywhere in the world with forests that are not alleged to have giant ape men in it. I mean, it seems to be a human thing to populate your forest with intelligent monsters. Yeah, something.
Mm-hmm.
Even Hawaii and Britain, which I would think would be mm-hmm. less likely, but no, they get the stories too.
Still have sightings, still have claims.
Yeah.
So was there anything else you wanted to discuss about this particular topic.
It'll come up again in the next thing we're going to talk about. And it's this idea of making computer models that could show how this works. I think that would be interesting. It's going to be more interesting in the next example. But I would like to know why sometimes this happens. I know, like just logically, in the simplest way, I know why it happens. Because sometimes trees fall in a way that they bump into each other and they mm-hmm. get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
But
absolutely.
It'd be interesting to see if there's any sort of mathematical modeling opportunity there. But that's more appropriate for the next thing that we'll talk about.
Yeah, so let's move on. And I don't know too much about this one. Fairy braids on animal manes. So something immediately springs to mind, but I'll let you delve into this a little.
So if you look for fairy braids, you'll also see them called witches' knots, fairy knots, and of course Bigfoot braids. This is you have a horse, and let's say you don't have its mane combed out smoothly. It goes mm-hmm. around, it's having a nice day, maybe it's a windy day, maybe it's not, whatever, or maybe you put it in mm-hmm. the barn all combed and wake up the next morning and the mane is tangled, and some of the tangles will be tangled in a way that resembles a deliberate braid. As in,
I would say a plait, but
okay, so you can say plait. Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah, sure. Yeah. And
this is an interesting one, and I don't know what I immediately think of is little kids maybe practicing braiding or plaiting on horses.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you have little kids around, that's
if not little kids, then fairies, obviously.
Well, it's an old belief. I mean, when I say fairy lore, I'm talking about this is an old belief, an old folk belief for why this happens. It's a real thing that definitely does happen, these natural knotted braids. And I say natural because I believe that that's what's happening. I think it's just a natural outcome of the way the hair is interacting. But
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think anyone's doing this, you know. In the Bigfoot world, some people have started advocating that what's happening is Bigfoot, Sasquatch is, you know, coming into these animals' areas and, you know, politely braiding their hair and then leaving.
But why?
Because they have a dream. They have a hairstyling dream, Karen, and I won't hear it put down.
stacking up sticks and plaiting horses' manes. Yeah,
yeah.
Makes sense.
Who knows what goes through the minds of Bigfoot?
Well, yeah. Who are we to judge?
Right. But it's even, I mean, it's, I hate to call it pseudo-academic research, but there's a lot of people who, you know, want to understand why Bigfoot does this, not going back to the more basic question of, does Bigfoot do this?
Right.
You know, so...
Yeah, exactly.
But there is an actual mathematical field of expertise around knotting and braids. I've actually, because I'm so curious about
highly
this.
Highly specialized?
Very specialized. And much like when I tried to get a giant snake expert on the show, when you reach out to mathematicians and ask them about, I'd like to see if there's a mathematical model for why horse hair might be self-braiding. Yeah, okay, I'm not getting a lot of callbacks on that, but...
Don't know why.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I would be delighted to be able to wield the mathematical skills to try to find a way to model this and that makes sense. But I think there's some interesting physics going on. Now, I'm saying all this about why I think it's natural, but let me tell you what, and I've already brought this up with some other colleagues who didn't agree with me, but I'm willing to I'll put it out there.
Hey, all right. Tossing out some ideas is probably better than a fairy or a Bigfoot. Right?
Well, yeah. So here's why I think it's natural. Okay. So in my house, I have many window blinds. And most of them have the deal where there's like a rod on one side you twist to open and close the blind. On the other side, there's a set of cords. Mm-hmm. I still don't understand why there's a set of cords, but there's four cords that you pull in together and it will raise and lower the blind, right?
I know where you're going with this. Yeah.
Yeah. Mine frequently knot themselves in such a way that it resembles braiding. And I'm not touching them.
I have seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have seen that.
What's happening is on the bottom of mine, a lot of this, where it happens the most is on windows that are near a floor vent. And so the floor vent blows up and catches the forehanging cords that have little like bell-like weights at the bottom. And it blows them around. And over the course of some time, I haven't put any time lapse on it, but over the course of some time, those go from being four separate unknotted cords into a knotted mess, often with segments that are braided. Like it'll have a central cord with two wrapped around it. It looks, or plaited. It looks very much like a hair braid. And it's it seems to be happening randomly.
Well, I'm immediately thinking of jewelry. If I go and look in my jewelry box, I have massive knotted necklaces.
Which is because Bigfoot hates you to wear jewelry and wants your necklaces knotted. So it sneaks in the house at night and knots your jewelry.
All the fairies. All the fairies. Depending on your beliefs. But another thing that comes to mind, have you, I'm sure you've heard about this whole Rat King.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, I love the Rat King. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. So I mean, I don't know too much about it other than that it's a situation where you'll find a number of rats that their tails are tangled or tied up together, knotted together.
Yes.
It apparently does happen occasionally with squirrels,
too. Squirrel kings and rat kings are real. Yeah, their tails.
Apparently, it's really rare in general.
Oh, yeah, it's very rare.
In some cases, they've been hoaxes as well, but it's really curious phenomenon.
So, and that's another one of those, how does this happen? You see the x-rays of some of the specimens they found, but probably in a situation where there was, you know, overpopulation and some kind of constriction on how much they could move, and then they end up with this horrible situation. So,
poor things.
And they probably kill each other. It's probably a very unpleasant way to go, but it does make for a really beautiful rat wreath if you want to dry one and put it on your door.
Yeah. For the Victorian times.
But I love the idea of the Rat King. It's I've seen it sort of depicted in, you know, fictional representations where it's just a bunch of rats that can kind of join together and form one, you know, entity, but that's not. It's really more of sort of this horrific outcome of overpopulation and rat tails being knotted together. It's not great.
All Bigfoot.
But the point being, though, that knotting does happen in nature. And sometimes
My hair is case in point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure dreadlocks are, you know, or can be the sort of natural outcome of not, you know, letting
nature
take its course.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Oh, yeah, not brushing your hair, not washing your hair, just basically letting it mat over a period of time. And yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I would get knots so bad at the nape of my neck that my mum would have to cut them out. I mean, almost like having a Persian cat when that happens. I remember going away on a school excursion for a couple of days and coming back and the knot was just so severe we had to cut it out. So Totally. Just from sleeping, not brushing it, tossing and turning on
yeah.
it. Even it gets caught in jackets and things like that and just tangles at the back. And I've got very fine hair too, which really is predisposed towards knotting.
I can't even find my hair.
But yeah, that's another interesting one. Anything else that you wanted to comment on that?
Well,
because there are
yeah, I'll put
there.
Some links. One of the things that I find interesting is that the a lot of times biological processes that seem complicated end up having a pretty simple algorithm that can explain them. Mm-hmm. So I guess the right. sort of famous is susurrations of starlings and fish. The way fish travel in schools, that sort of thing. And it turns out that sometimes some very simple algorithms can explain really complicated outcomes of behavior. And so I'm wondering if something like that might be true within the breeding world. I think an experiment to like set up my cord blinds and putting a time lapse on it, you know, starting with unknotted and see over time, you know, how that turns out might be of interest. But I think there's
yeah,
some,
I wonder how long it does take. I mean,
yeah.
it seems like it wouldn't just happen overnight. Well, perhaps it could.
It can literally happen overnight. But I guess the thing is with horses, I don't know how to go about doing a time lapse on that. It would be very uncomfortable for the horse, you know. I don't know. That'd be
yeah.
interesting.
Well, the picture that you have in there almost looks like dreadlocks, looks like a kind of matting.
Yeah. I mean, and it's going to be – usually it's a mix of there's a braided section and not – Not braided section.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'll put some links in there on that because I just think there's probably a way to mathematically model this. I don't know if any of our listeners are either mathematicians who work in this field or know someone who does, but it's an interesting question. I'd love to hear from someone who studies that topic more expertly than just keeping my hair untangled. You know that. But I do think there's some connection, some parallel between the way the blind cords hang and the way the hair is braided. So, but that leaves us for our third mystery.
Yeah. So this is one that I've kind of heard about, but I guess never really questioned very much. But you were interested in talking about silver coins for frontier milk preservation.
Yeah. So this came out of my extensive silver bullet and werewolf research, which is still ongoing. I've got some updates.
Still ongoing.
Yeah, because I found Justin Mullis pointed me to some earlier books, I think from 1915, that include a silver bullet. So I'm pretty excited about this new angle.
Very cool. So what's this theory?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
Oh, so the idea is, so what I came across was, so let me just say that it led me to look into silver in medicine because there's a lot of claims. I know you're familiar with colloidal silver being, touted as a great antibacterial, and we see great pictures of people who abuse it and turn their skin permanently blue. It's good times.
Yeah, my mother used to take it, and stepfather, and I had lots of discussions to try and talk them out of it. And it wasn't until there was a kind of falsification of the belief insofar as they got sick and it didn't work that they stopped taking it. So luckily it didn't get to that point where they turned blue.
Yeah, it's a peculiar case because there's some real science to silver and antibacterial properties, but not the way people think. And that's where it gets quite confused.
I've heard of that with copper as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you what the real effect is. It's called the oligodynamic effect, and it happens down at the molecular level. And we scientists believe it's because if the silver is in the correct state of like, you know, not oxidized, sort of pure silver, that it can stop bacteria from reproducing properly. Like it messes up, whether it's an electrical thing or something else, it can affect their ability to reproduce, which then causes them to fail, which is what we want. But the legend is that in frontier days, when people were traveling across the country, or out in the wilderness, whatever, they would milk their cows into milk jugs, and they would put a silver coin in the milk jug that would make the milk stay fresh longer because they didn't have refrigeration. Now that was the original claim, and I thought, well, that seems eminently testable. Now, so as a science fair project, I want to describe that, what that would look like. But before we do that, I just want to also add, I did some additional research that suggests that this is not actually what was going on, or at least not the reasons we might think. But let's first talk about what the science experiment might look like. So the idea would be you would take raw milk from a dairy or from a cow. That's got to be raw milk because if you're using pasteurized milk, it's already been treated against bacterial growth. So that's not a fair experiment. Second of all, you're going to need to get some pure silver coins, which means you're probably going to have to hit an antique shop because none of the coins made today are pure silver.
Could you use silver jewelry or something instead?
Did you not see it said silver coin? No, I don't. I assume any sort of ingot of pure silver would be fine.
But
in the frontier, I don't know if they spent time polishing the silver. So you might need to do some control experiments where you have a polished and an unpolished silver, you know.
See that tarnishing effect.
Because, I mean, that tarnishes the outside coating becoming oxidized. So it's not going to be chemically active anymore. So whatever effect might be going on with the silver coin when the bacteria, I don't think it's going to be as strong or happen at all if the coin is tarnished. However, I'm not a numismatist, if I said that right. I don't do coins. but my understanding is also if you have an antique coin, you shouldn't clean it because that sort of
the
patina is part of the value. Exactly. So So I not sure how to approach that to, you know, not mess up an antique coin's value. But anyway, you would set up a controlled experiment where you have a control group of raw milk with no coin. You have some with a pure silver coin. Maybe you have some with a clean coin. You need different groups, and you would need some what do you call them? Petri dishes with an agar solution. You know, to pour the raw milk in and make sure the bacteria can grow, and then see if those coins have any impact on the growth or not. So, I mean, it's a pretty basic experiment. Now, the funny thing is, I had looked into this before and thought it would be a great experiment, but I couldn't find any evidence anyone had done it. Today, I was using a different search engine because Google is no longer great. I was using KAGI, and it brought up a bunch of great links that I had not seen before. And one of them was a 2005 science fair project, and it was very close to the experiment I wanted to do, but they were using colloidal silver, not a silver coin. And so I don't think that their conclusions were relevant to this experiment.
But close anyway.
Yeah. But it does bring up this funny kind of a thing about history. So a long time ago, and it's still this is sort of part of my technology research, I did a paper called did an article called Who Invented Pasteurization? And, you know, you would think Louis Pasteur. Right, exactly. But what the funny part is, what I had discovered was in the late 1700s, I found an article. I found the article from the late 1700s. I was not, you know, poking around in the 1700s with a time machine or anything. But in the late 1700s, I found an article describing how to preserve milk for a voyage, and it talked about boiling the milk and then storing the sealed bottles down in the bottom of the ship hold, and then when you pull them out and warm them up, they're all good to go. And yeah, and so
it was a thing.
It was a thing, and it actually turns out that Napoleon was trying to feed his troops, and he gave a prize in the late 1700s to anyone who could find a way to preserve food. And a guy came up with this thing where he would take champagne jars, bottles, big bottles, and he would fill them with peas and carrots and vegetables and boil them. And that actually solved the mystery. And he won a huge cash, sort of the equivalent of a modern X Prize, for finding a way to preserve food. So that was before 1800 or right around 1800. Now, you may think, well, wait a minute, but pasteurization, right? Well, here's the thing. Over and over again in the history of technology, people figure out a way to make things work, and then years later, they figure out why they work. And that is almost always the case. Almost always the case. And so in this case, Pasteur figured out a systematized method for reliably killing the bacteria, and he did numerous experiments that proved that that it was specific bacteria causing the products to fail. And by products, in this case, I mean beer, which was the food product that had hired Pasteur to solve the mystery of how could we keep our beer bottles from exploding with bad beer. So, so thanks to beer and Pasteur, we know why and how it works, but the actual method for preservation is actually 100 years older. So that was a long way to go. Yeah.
This makes me think of another kind of folklore, a story that's out there. When I was visiting my mum last year in Australia, she opened a bottle of ginger beer and didn't finish it all. And she said, so I'm going to put it back in the fridge and I'm going to put a spoon in it because that will keep it fizzy still.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a belief that's out there.
Oh, there's not, in my family, there's a belief if you drop a Coke and you tap the lid before you open it, that it won't explode everywhere. This is preposterous, but I cannot convince the person who I care about very much and I don't feel like arguing with that what they're doing there is a magical ritual and in no way has anything to do with whether the drink explodes. So, yeah.
It's pretty much the same thing for the spoon. I mean, yeah, I tested it a couple of days later and it still had the spoon in there. It's supposed to be a silver spoon. It was probably stainless steel. But, yeah, it didn't work.
Now,
but that's another similar one.
So the school project, the science fair project, could determine whether or not this is efficacious or not. But what I found really funny is this morning I ran into a folklore legend that actually was a better explanation for why people might have been doing this. Although the history of silver in medicine goes back all the way to ancient Rome, a lot of people, especially people selling colloidal silver, will say, well, that's, you know, it works. That's why it's been around forever. You got to remember, though, that ancient medicine, if you read those medical books, they're full of things that are true and they're full of things that are false. It was the scientific ability to figure out what works and what doesn't, not that you wrote the things down that makes But what I ran across was this legend that said, and I love this, it says, witches can turn milk into clabber very soon, but this may be prevented by putting a silver coin in the milk. And we know that the idea that silver wards off witches is a much older idea than anything to do with vampires. So it may have been that people put silver in milk to prevent it from clotting, but it may be that that was to avoid witches, not, you know, any kind of insight into bacteria.
I want to put something else out there too. In reading this, it just makes me think about the socioeconomic group that we're talking about. So these would have been lower socioeconomic group, poor people. I just wonder how many of them would have had any silver to put into their milk. And if they were in a situation where they needed to preserve their milk because they couldn't afford to buy it fresh or buy it frequently, then I doubt that if they had any silver, they'd be putting it into milk. It just, from a practical perspective.
Yeah, I don't know how common the silver coins were. Yeah, exactly. If you managed to keep a silver coin, do you really use it for milk or do you use it to buy stuff? You know, I don't know.
Well, yeah, and a lot of people would have been, you know, bartering and dealing with goods and services rather than necessarily money. But I did Google it myself, and I came across a book that mentions something a little bit different. And it says the book's called Metal Nanoparticles Synthesis and Applications in Pharmaceutical Sciences. And there was just a little mention of this particular folklore. And it says silver vessels and formulations had also been believed for centuries to exhibit antimicrobial and therapeutic properties. In olden times, people in India used to preserve milk by placing silver coins in the milk.
Interesting. And I've heard
so that's putting it in a different culture.
Poor people saying that wealthy people used silver vessels because it prevented bacteria. And I imagine they might think it prevented poisons and other things. There's all kinds of beliefs, you know.
And there's theories about that with copper.
Yeah. And remember, silverware, you know, we think of it now as silverware, but it's usually not silver, first of all. And second of all, it was literally part of your wealth.
I mean, you know, in Australia,
it was like having a bank. And what did thieves steal when they broke in your house? Your silverware. You know, it's like
candelabras.
Yeah, exactly. So finding the valuables. But these were things that were kept for families for generations as a way to maintain and preserve wealth. So,
well, yeah, you've reminded me that my step grandfather had a set of silverware, actual silverware, so made of silver, and it tarnished horribly. And I remember my mother trying to keep it clean for the longest time, and then I think just giving it away or selling it off. Because
I really, really, really need to take all my werewolf research and other silver related things and put together a monograph, because there's so much, like so many folklore. Like, for example, I've seen it written that in ye olde days, I don't know, I guess this is pre-industrial times, you didn't have to polish the silver because the air was cleaner. And now, because of all the industrialization and stuff, the things in the air will almost instantly tarnish your silver. I don't know if that's true.
I just remember going to New Zealand quite some time ago and going to Rotorua, where you have all the geothermal activity, and all of my silver jewelry, everything I wore, just tarnished terribly, and my clothing stank as well. I had
was that the sulfur in the air, that kind of thing, or
yes. I mean, this is all incredibly interesting, and I think some really fun ideas for science fair projects.
It's not monsters. I don't think fairies or Bigfoot are doing these things. And I don't think silver's magic.
You party pooper.
But I am curious to know more. I mean, a better understanding of what is true about silver and what is false about silver is something the public could actually, I think, benefit from.
Yeah, well, so I'm seeing a more broad book than just talking about werewolves. I think just silver.
Hey. I'm just telling you what I like. Well, it would start off as a normal book, and it would change into a werewolf book. That's how that works, Karen.
Right, yeah. Well, that would be the big focus, the big idea.
So, just wait for the full moon, and then the research just changes. So,
yeah. Gets all hairy.
That's right.
Well, thank you for doing all this research. I mean, these are really interesting topics.
I'll throw lots of show notes in there, and you know, if anybody has ideas, I'd love to hear about them, you know. I think some fun experiments could be done with some of this. I would really love to talk to someone who understands the mathematics of knotting and braiding. That I think it's fascinating that the math can do something with that at all, because it looks very chaotic to me, and I know chaos is another kind of math. Yeah. But yeah, it's fascinating.
Sure. Well, someday we'll find the appropriate person who will want to talk about that with us.
All right. We'll see you next week.
See you soon.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard a discussion about three mini mysteries that we've come across while researching this show. Mysteries I thought might be fun for our audience to ponder. And as I've said before, and will definitely say again, many a critical thinker has sharpened their minds first on the whetstone of Bigfoot. I look forward to hearing from you on our Patreon forums or in an email, and you can also discuss these on our Facebook page. I'm not there, but Karen forwards me interesting tidbits. And behind the scenes, I'm also working on a Discord server instance, because I'd like to be able to have audience interactions that are unmitigated by the weird algorithm curation and confusing experience of most social media. It's fun to see monster memes and jokes and whatnot, but I like actually engaging in interesting discussion and research that I can later easily find or revive if new info comes along. So maybe that's what Discord will be for us. I'm not sure. Stay tuned. And in personal news, my wife found a great job and started this week. So hopefully that portion of my brain that has been stuck in a cognitive loop concerning how can I pay all these bills will finally free up in a few weeks so I can think about fun stuff like monsters and technology. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. If you've been listening to this show while you sneak into people's barns to braid their horses' manes, well, that's hilarious. Rock on.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.